Finish Shmuel Aleph today, so we can go on to Shmuel Bet, which of course is really one sefer. Yeah, I believe we're in Perek Chaf Gimel, so we actually have a lot of basic material to cover. Just in terms of the basic rest of the sefer, as you know, the rest of the sefer really deals with number one, David's continued pursuit by Shaul, and number two, the very interesting concept of Shaul going to a witch or a sorceress to bring up the soul of Shmuel from the grave, and number three, the death of Shaul, and in particular the contradictions in the biblical narratives as to how did Shaul die. Did he kill himself, or was his life taken? Basically, in chapter 23, Perek Chaf Gimel, which is, we kind of ended in the middle last week, you'll recall that David had saved a city in Eretz Yisrael, a city called Keilah, that's Kuf Ayin, from the Philistines. Shaul, yeah, Kuf Ayin Yud Lamed Hey, Keilah, it's just the city that is mentioned. Shaul then surrounds Keilah, and David, by consultation with his resident priest, consults the Urim V'Tumim, whether the people of Keilah, if they're threatened with their lives, will they deliver David to them, to the enemy? And the conclusion was that they would. So David, with 600 people, makes his escape, and he hides in what is called the Desert of Ziph, Midbar Ziph, which was really just a region in the Judean desert. Now it's interesting that the Ziphim are continuously portrayed as traitor always depends on what side of the equation you are. I mean, many people consider George Washington a traitor, you know, in 1774. So I don't want to say they're traitors, but they're traitors to David because they are loyalists. Maybe we'll call them Tories. They're loyalists to Shaul.
Why was Washington?
When the American colonies rebelled against Great Britain, there were those who would say, these are traitors, right? Benedict Arnold was a loyal person to the government, right? So it all depends on what side of a revolution you happen to be on. But be it as it may, the Ziphim continuously, Ziphim, the people of the region of Ziph, the Ziphim continuously were the ones that were always telling Shaul where David's whereabouts were. And in fact, if you look in the Tehillim, look in the Psalms of David, you will see a number of psalms that are written that contain the inscription at the beginning of the psalm. This was said as David was hiding in the caves when the Ziphim revealed his whereabouts, right? So this obviously was something that very deeply impressed itself on David's mind, particularly since, according to Chazal, at least in terms of the geographical location, Ziph is located in the territory of Yehuda. It's the Judean desert. And as a result, the people of Ziph are from the tribe of Yehuda, and one would have expected that there would be a certain amount of loyalty to David HaMelech. But the Ziphim turn him, they don't turn him over, they reveal his whereabouts, and David manages to escape at various times. One point, I think I mentioned this last week, just to go over this, that chapter 23, this issue about the people of Keilah being threatened by Shaul, well actually, it never happened, David escaped before that time, but David essentially asked the Urim V'Tumim, if Shaul demands, deliver me or I'll kill the city, will they concede to that demand? The Urim V'Tumim answered yes, and therefore David decided he had to leave. In other words, it hadn't actually happened that way. But as I indicated last week, this gives rise to the very important halachic debates as to what if we go to the city, the non-Jewish enemy goes to the city and says, deliver me one of your inhabitants, or I will murder the entire city. So you'll recall, according to the halakha, if the demander did not specify which person he was asking for, give me one of you, or I will kill you all, the halakha is that we are not allowed to choose which person will die, even if that means all of us will die, because we're not allowed to become direct accessories to murder, even if the net result will be we'll all die. On the other hand, when the enemy asks for a specifically identified person, give us Reuven, or give us David, or we will wipe out the whole city, then we have a machloket in the Gemara. This is in the Jerusalem Talmud, between Rabbi Yochanan and his brother-in-law, Rav Shimon ben Lakish. They always argue, as brother-in-laws do. Of course, just to digress for a second, this rabbi, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, who is often called Reish Lakish, as you know, has a very interesting history. In his earlier career, he was a highway robber, and he had once attacked Rabbi Yochanan, as Rabbi Yochanan was traveling, and Rabbi Yochanan admired Reish Lakish's physical strength, because he jumped and all sorts of things, acrobatics, and Rabbi Yochanan said, a man like you should give his strength to the study of Torah. You would be very successful with all your energy and strength. And Rav Shimon ben Lakish, who was a bit coarse, Rav Yochanan apparently was a very beautiful person, he said, you ought to give your beauty to a prostitution. He said to Rav Yochanan. So Rav Yochanan said, if you think I'm pretty, I have a sister who's even much more beautiful, and I'm sure that if you would dedicate yourself to become a learned person in the Torah, I could convince my sister to marry you. So it is said that Rav Shimon ben Lakish was interested in the proposal, and he became a devoted student of the Torah. It's interesting that the Midrash records, the Gemara records, that as soon as he made the commitment to study Torah, he lost some of his physical strength. He couldn't, because it says the study of Torah weakens the body sometimes, because it emphasizes the soul. But be it as it may, Rav Shimon ben Lakish in time, of course, became a great great rabbi and a great scholar, and he's considered to be what we call a Talmid Chaver of Rav Yochanan. Talmid Chaver means you're a disciple, but you're a colleague. In other words, you're not quite a disciple, you're kind of equal, but a little below. And one of the frequent pairs of disputants in the Talmud, the people that are always arguing, is Rabbi Yochanan and his brother-in-law, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. It's interesting that it is said that whenever Rabbi Yochanan would teach something, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish would raise 24 questions, 24 objections to the teaching. And when Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish died, he was replaced by another person, Rabbi Kahana, who every time Rabbi Yochanan said something, Rabbi Kahana would offer 24 reasons why Rabbi Yochanan was correct. So it is said that Rav Yochanan began to weep and sob at how much he missed Reish Lakish. So somebody said, what do you mean? Reish Lakish was giving you trouble all the time, and here Rav Kahana says you're perfect. Now what's the problem? So he says, that was the point. I didn't need somebody to tell me I was. I would say that I didn't think I was right. But when Reish Lakish would question me and attack me, and I would have to clarify my position, so if I was wrong, I would correct myself. If I was right, I understood it better. He says, that was the true way that a person grows, is by that type of challenge and having to reformulate your position. And of course, this is actually a very good metaphor even for marriage itself, in the sense that it says when God created Chava, God says, let us make a helpmate to be opposite him. Eselo ezer kenegdo. So the Gemara itself says there's a contradiction. Is a marriage partner to be a helpmate? Or is the marriage partner to be in opposition? So Rashi quotes the Gemara that says, if you're lucky, you get the helpmate. If you're not lucky, you get the opposition. Meaning, it's one or the other. But in the...
It's not lucky, if you're kind.
Well, it doesn't. It says if you merit. You can interpret it different ways. If you merit.
And it's so true. If a husband is a nice husband, she'll be nice to you.
Well, hopefully that's so. Although I'll tell you another story about that in a second. But but in the Hasidic works, they say a beautiful thought. They say that these are not contradictions. The help that a spouse brings to the other spouse is the opposition. What do we mean opposition? We don't mean opposition in terms of arguing, but we mean in seeing the world in different ways. In other words, if all you have is of course you can't have a same-sex clone, but if all is a clone of yourself, there is no possibility of really growing and becoming transformed, because you just become reconfirmed in your good points, indeed, but also your prejudices and your mistakes. So the Azer is what you might call, to use a political science term, loyal opposition. Right? We don't really don't have in the United States a concept of loyal opposition, because the opposition is always trying to undermine. But the loyal opposition was the concept in which, you know, we fundamentally, you know, love each other, care about each other, have a relationship with each other. Within that context, you know, each one is willing to point out where the other one might be seeing things not in a fully correct way. And in fact, that's the greatest sign of love, both for parents and for spouses, is that we don't let the other person simply continue in a way that we think is destructive, but we're willing to have the courage to talk about those things. So, be it as it may, okay, this was a kind of a long digression on Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish, but I'm just bringing this in. Oh, that story, yeah, yeah. The story is, Rav, who was really one of the greatest rabbis of the Talmud, that's why he's called Rav, the rabbi, right? He's not even, his name was Abba, but he's called Rav. Rav had a wife, apparently, who was a very contrarian woman. And whatever he asked for, she always did him, made him the opposite. If he asked for beans, she made him, I guess not potatoes, but she made him something else. So, one time, Rav's son, you know, Rav told his son, please ask your mother to make me this for supper. And Rav's son was a smart boy, and he figured out...
So he told her the other way around.
So when Rav got what he asked for, he asked his son, what did you tell your mother? And he said, well, I changed. And he says, well, you don't lie. You should always tell the truth. But now, of course, maybe Rav, you know, I don't know, maybe Rav figured that out. Rav really wanted the opposite of what he asked for. That's why I said, so who knows?
Who knows? Why did he get rid of her?
Well, no. So the question was raised. Like, you know, why don't you divorce her?
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I'm eternally, no matter what these little things are, he says, I'm eternally grateful that no children and, you know, she gives me a home. That's what he said.
Maybe he loved her so much.
These other things, he considered, these other things, as frustrating as they might be, he considered to be minor in comparison to what he felt that the gratitude that he had, which is, you know, a great achievement. But be it as it may, this machloket, again, has nothing to do with what I just discussed, other than the names, but the machloket is a very fundamental machloket, and that is, the oppressor, the non-Jewish oppressor, surrounds the city and says, give us Reuven, give us a specific person, so we will kill him or we will wipe out the whole city. So it is Rav Yochanan's position that if a specifically identified person is requested, the city has the right and the permission to deliver him unto his death.
Oh, that's magical.
Even though he might be morally blameworthy. Blameless, I'm sorry. And the reason is, Rav Yochanan's position is that he becomes what you might call an involuntary rodef. What's a rodef? A rodef is somebody who threatens my life. If a specific person threatens my life, maybe the simple example is somebody pulls a gun to me, so the halacha is, habal lahargecha, somebody who's trying to kill you, you kill them first. Now, Rav Yochanan's point is, though, and it's an unusual extension, that the concept of the endangerer that you're allowed to take out of commission does not only apply to the malevolent, evil person who intentionally tries to kill you, but it even applies to a person who becomes a rodef through no fault of his own. In other words, the concept is, if the reason our lives are in danger is because of this guy Reuven, then Reuven, even against his will, has become the rodef, and as a rodef, we are allowed to kill him, even to kill him to save our lives. Now, this is Rav Yochanan's position. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish rejects that position. He says it is not just that if the Nazis are looking for, you know, a particular Jew, that Jew should become a rodef because of the Nazis who are singling him out, and therefore Rav Shimon ben Lakish adds the position that in order for the identified person to become a rodef, he must be guilty of some crime, again, beyond this point, it's a little tricky, for which the death penalty is justifiable. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if he murdered someone, mm-hmm, and then even if the enemy says, deliver this murderer to us or we will kill you all, then he might have become a rodef, but he cannot become a rodef simply by the process of being singled out. Now Maimonides, again, it's an argument in the Talmud, you shall me. Maimonides in the Mishnah follows the opinion of Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Actually, the truth is, in terms of the rules of halachic decision making, is actually a little unusual, because normally primacy of halacha is given to Rav Yochanan's view, but for various reasons, Maimonides follows Rav Shimon ben Lakish, which would mean that even what is called yichud, yichud is the term specific designation, even when they are asking for a specific person, you cannot deliver him unless he is guilty of some capital crime. Of course, again, keep in mind, though, that this standard is a very, very tricky question. Do we mean guilty of a capital crime under the laws of the Torah? Or do we mean guilty of a capital crime under the laws of the oppressor? And what if it's an unjust? What if you're guilty of a capital crime because you took bread, you know, for, you know, I mean, from somebody, and, you know, you get killed for speculation or whatever it is? Well, what exactly do we mean by a capital crime? That's very, very tricky. Now, if we apply this, now I just want to apply this as a theoretical exercise to the issue of Shaul pursuing David. Shaul, of course, it didn't happen because David escaped first. Shaul surrounds the city of Keilah. And Shaul says to the people of Keilah, deliver to me David, or I will massacre the entire city.
He says so?
Well, David is afraid that that would happen.
Yeah.
Oh, this is, it didn't happen because David already escaped. But this is what David asks the Urim and Thummim. Will they deliver me? Now, let's ask it in terms of a pure halachic exercise. What are the responsibilities of the people of Keilah? Would they be permitted to deliver David in order to save their own lives? Again, if we apply to this the Talmudic dispute, Rabbi Yochanan would say they could certainly give David over because David was a designated person who qualifies as a pursuer. But if we take Rav Shimon ben Lakish's position, which is Maimonides' rule, it becomes very ambiguous. Was David a person who committed any type of crime for which he should be executed? Well, the answer is, it depends from whose perspective. Shaul, you see, considers David to be engaged in treason, and treason is indeed a crime, which is called moreid b'malchut, rebelling against the malchut, for which execution is justified.
Adultery is not a crime?
Adultery? Oh, that didn't happen yet.
Oh,
David was not.
Heaven,
yeah.
It comes later.
That's much later. Yeah, yeah, we're not there. That's the end of Shmuel Bet.
Excuse my ignorance.
Yeah,
you
we're not there.
The
right. Now, yeah. In fact, you can even see the movie, I think, isn't there? Yeah. But it's very, very interesting that this ambiguity that I highlighted in Maimonides, whether it has to be something that's warranted or from the perspective of the oppressor, actually raises that issue here. Now, of course, I should mention that there's yet another concept Maimonides doesn't address, but you have to superimpose on this debate. There are those that say that the whole machloket between Rabbi Yochanan and Rav Shimon ben Lakish, whether you can deliver a person who is not guilty of anything, only pertains to where that person would have the possibility of escape. In other words, if the choice really is, give us one person or we'll kill you all, the argument might be, well, this one person is going to die anyway, so why shouldn't I give him? In other words, one could argue that if death is inevitable either way, of course, how do you ever know that? Then the argument goes, no, well, I think it does, because here's the choice. Generally, we cannot choose one life over another life. We can't say, you know, we're better than him. We can't even say 100 people are better than one. But the one thing I think we could say is that the lives of 100 people should outweigh the life of one if that one is going to die along with the 100.
But I think the fallacy of the argument, though, is that you're dealing with an honest and moral person who's saying,
yeah,
I'll just kill that one person and then I'll leave everyone else alone and go
away.
If he's going to kill that one person, why is he going to come back and kill...
Well, first of all, in the case of Shaul, that's a very, very logical assumption. You're right, with the Nazis and terrorists and everything else, the whole thing breaks down. You're saying basically don't give in to those demands because you never know. In the case of Shaul, however, I think it's fairly clear that there is a specific person that he's looking for. So,
right,
at least in this case, and again, you know, a lot of the Talmudic cases are really theoretical constructs. You're correct. In the practicalities of it, there are always going to be those issues. Yeah.
If you say he's guilty, wouldn't you have to have a trial? How would you establish the person?
Well, it's very, very clear that in the Maimonides case, the non-Jews are not talking about trying somebody, they're talking about summarily executing. So the question is, how do we know somebody's guilty? Is it just based on the allegation itself? You know, these are open questions. He doesn't really clearly address what those issues are. Yeah.
Wandering around 600 armed warriors.
Right.
Certainly looks like
suspicious. Well, yeah.
Good point.
Well, yes, of course. David still occasionally gives people the line that he's on some secret mission from the king. Of course, but then that's when he went to Nov by himself. But you're right, there is this, basically it is kind of a little government, mini government in exile, or an army in exile, or whatever we would call it. By the way, in chapter 23, when David escapes from Keilah, he does have his final meeting with Yonatan. Yonatan actually goes out to meet him in the forest, and it is described as a very emotional meeting with great tears and weeping. There's no indication that Yonatan was aware at this point that he would die very soon, but that's certainly foreshadowed by the emotion of the last meeting. And in chapter 23, we are told that Shaul almost got hold of David, but the last minute he was saved by the bell. Philistines were calling, and Shaul had to call up his group to go fight the Philistine. And because of this, the site at which this happens, it's an interesting double pun, the site at which Shaul virtually apprehended David and then had to leave is called Sela HaMachlokets. That means the rock. Now, Machloket is an interesting double pun. Machloket means dissension, argument. It also means splitting. Of course, it's the same word, but here the concept is, this is the rock, the mountain, of which the machloket of Shaul and David, but also they split because David went one way, Shaul was called off.
Did you really have
more pressing
Sela?
Sela is a mountain here. It doesn't mean a civil rock. It was a mountain. Well, basically, it says that Shaul was ascending one side of the hill, and David was running away down the other side, and Shaul had virtually apprehended David at this point, but saved by the bell, the Philistines were doing some stuff, and Shaul had to take away his army to deal with the Philistines. But of course, Shaul, as soon as Philistine business is over for the time being, because they always come back, Shaul does return. In other words, this is obviously something that's very important to Shaul, that he's not going to let a little Philistine business dissuade him from the primary activity of hunting down David. And at this point, David is in a different midbar. He's not in the midbar of Ziph anymore, but he's called the Midbar of Ein Gedi. If you've been to Israel, you know Ein Gedi, which is described in Song of Songs as well, is one of the most beautiful portions of the land. It is, of course, a desert area, but in the desert there are beautiful oases and waterfalls as well as a number of wild animals.
What happened there?
Ein Gedi? Well, Ein Gedi is simply where David is hiding out. New Midbar. And there are also wild animals such as mountain lions and the like in Ein Gedi. Right, right. Now, Shaul now takes 3,000 men. So he's kind of outnumbered David. David has his 600. Shaul takes more than three times that number. And here we have encounter number one. People often confuse. There are two different times that David could have killed Shaul. And people often confuse the encounter. Number one is Shaul goes into a cave to relieve himself. And he's by himself. He's private.
And David is there.
Yeah, and David and his men, although I can't imagine 600 people are in a single cave. There must be, but David and some of his closest people, apparently, are in the very back of the cave. And lo and behold, the one who enters without guards, without attendants, without security, is Shaul, without his whatever present spear. And what David does is, apparently Shaul removed his garments, he put it somewhere, and David was able to cut off a piece of the garment that Shaul did not notice, the knaf mi'il, the corner of the garments. And when Shaul leaves the cave, I guess not noticing that something from his garment is missing, David calls out from the cave and says, you know, our master, Mashiach Hashem, he calls him the anointed one of God, look what I could have done to you. I cut off your garment. I was so close. I could have killed you. And he tries to show by that that he is not an enemy of Shaul. Not only is he not an enemy, but he still regards Shaul as Mashiach Hashem, the anointed, right? As you know, the word Mashiach does not connote specifically the Messiah. The word Mashiach comes from anointed, and based on the idea that kings were anointed by oil. That was a sign of divine grace. So anyone, any royal or even priestly function, Kohanim are also called Mashiach or Mashiach, that is anointed by oil for a divine mission is called the Mashiach. Or at least, in fact, it's not always Jewish. King Cyrus. Cyrus was the Persian king who allowed the Babylonian exiles to return to Jerusalem to build the temple, is called the Mashiach Hashem, the Anointed One of God. So it's not limited to the final Messiah.
Don't say that he was from a Jewish heritage, is that true?
No, Cyrus was not. Ahasuerus had a child from Queen Esther, Darius the second, who was Jewish, obviously, because Esther was Jewish.
Why was he good to the Jews?
Well, it says he wanted the Jews to pray for him. I mean, you know, basically, you know, even in the Roman Empire, you know, there are occasionally kings who are good to the Jews. Now, of course, as you know, what happens is Shaul is immediately, kind of in the his vacillation of moods, he immediately is saddened. Then he apologizes and says, "Is that you, my beloved son David? Now I see how much you care about me, and how could I be this way?" And again, I would not suggest that this is insincere. I would say that Shaul is seized by his emotions at very different times, and at some moments there is genuine tenderness and love for what he calls his son David. Was a river of trust but verify, meaning to say, David does not make the mistake of approaching Shaul at that point. He stays in the cave, but at that point they seem to part at very good terms. Now, at chapter 24, there is a reference that seems to be out of place, the very end of Perek Chafdalek, and that is it talks about the death of Shmuel, and Shmuel died. Of course, Shmuel had already died. In fact, it's pointed out that in the book of Shmuel, Shmuel keeps on dying. Not only that, but after he dies, he comes back. In other words, which is unique, by the way, this is the only figure in the entire Tanakh that is described as coming back from the dead. But in a way, he always comes back from the dead, because he's already given his farewell speech, and he died, and then says he died again. And some of the commentaries suggest different ideas. I mean, some want to say that Shmuel's first death, remember when Mark Twain, there was an obituary report, right. This reports of my death have been greatly exaggerated, that Shmuel essentially retired from public life, so it's as if he died, but he was still around, and at various points, you know, he physically died later. But there's also a concept that when the Navi, the author of the book, who of course is not Shmuel at this point, wants to indicate the fact that certain things happened because of the absence of this prophet, it reiterates that he died, not to say that he died now, but to say because Shmuel wasn't here, certain things happened that wouldn't have happened had he been alive. So sometimes, and you'll see what this is, sometimes the repetition of Shmuel's death is not designed to tell me this is where he died, but it's designed to indicate because he was not here, this set the scene for what was to happen. And that's chapter 25. In chapter 25...
parallel,
yeah.
From Judges, where, you know, there was no king...
Right, it's similar to people did what was Yashar B'Einav, and that's correct, that's a good comparison. And chapter 25, I have to admit, is a disturbing story. Chapter 25 is the story of how David... Now remember, David so far has one wife. He's not even with him. David's one wife,
Michal,
is of course Michal, the daughter of Shaul. But if you recall, we did learn that when David went into hiding as a fugitive, what Shaul did was, I guess to make a point that David is not a member of the royal house anymore, is he actually took Michal and he gave her to another man. This other man, the other man is Palti ben Eliash. Now, Palti ben Laish, just his name, we don't know that much about him, just to remind people that at the beginning, that's the first things that David does after Shaul dies is he reclaims his wife Michal from this Palti Ben Laish. I'll discuss a little later how could Shaul do it. Again, note that to some degree the same thing that David does to Bathsheba, Shaul does to him in advance. There's, again, I think this may confirm an observation I made last week, that to some degree David's parent in being a monarch might be Shaul himself, because David sometimes replicates what Shaul did to him. In fact, even with Avshalom, we find that David goes to a city and says, deliver someone to me or I'll wipe out the city. Exactly what would have happened in Keilah. But so far, therefore, David only has one wife that's not even with him. Chapter 25 gives us the story of how David married his second wife, whose name was Avigail. And the story is not, such a great story in terms of David. He comes across as very, very tough in this sense. Names are very important here, and this is an example of a woman saving the family once again. Of course, one could even make a story. I came across a book which was a feminist commentary on Shmuel, which emphasizes the role of women in saving situations. Of course, we have Hannah. Of course, we have Avigail. We have Michal. We even have the witch at the end of the book, who plays a very, very major role. But be it as it may, names are very significant. Avigail, which is Abigail, means my father rejoices, which is a name of God. Oh, God rejoices in the child. But her husband is interesting. Her husband's name is Nabal. And Nabal means a disgusting, repulsive person. And indeed, that is an intentional pun. The narrator of the book makes very clear, Nabal Shmo, but Nabal who? Nabal is his name, and he was a person of very disgusting and repulsive midot. He is described as a wealthy, not the landowner, but a wealthy sheep herder. He owns a lot of sheep, etc. And he is described as Kalavi, which is an interesting word. Kalavi. Kaf Lamet Bet Yud. Now Kalavi, one might be tempted to relate Kalev to dog. He was dog-like, perhaps in the sense of his selfishness. A dog does not share its food with others. And therefore, we could describe, although I love dogs too, but the point is that dogs are not into sharing their food. You know? The dog keeps what he has for himself, and therefore it may reflect a selfish temperament. Although the commentaries give much less of a dramatic interpretation of Kalavi, they say he was of the family of Kalev, which is a also David's family, which kind of makes it worse. Now, David comes to Nabal, and he does what he does several times later as well. He takes his 600 people, he divides it into two groups. 200 stay with their property to watch things. 400, so imagine this, he goes to Nabal, him and a group of 400 people, which by the way is very, very striking, because it's very reminiscent of Esav meeting Yaakov. It says Esav meets Yaakov. In fact, we actually see what Abigail does is reminiscent of what Yaakov does to Esav. I think there's a parallel here, where Esav meets Yaakov with 400 soldiers. And David basically says, you know, listen, we were very nice to your shepherds. Of course, a little strange. We never took anything from your shepherds as they were grazing their sheep. Again, that's hardly an accommodation. You know, we never stole anything from you. We never harassed you. But he also says, we provided you with protection and security from the other enemies and the like. Protection money. So David says, why don't you give our people supplies, food, water, and everything else, and, you know, everything will be great. So Nabal is very sarcastic. Nabal says, who are you? And society gets pretty bad when you have all these slave people that are running around. And he even says that these days, sounds like kind of an old grouchy conservative, these days you got this riffraff who break away from their masters and don't know their limitations and don't know their place, going around making demands on people. And he says, why should I waste my wealth on you? Okay, well, so far, this was a tolerable type of conversation, where basically David
asked,
he wanted food. David asked for food. Nabal is a selfish man. He says no. Where things get a little strange and perhaps overreactive is David's response to Nabal turning him down, where Nabal basically says, we're going to destroy this whole group. We'll destroy him, destroy his family, destroy his people, destroy his plunder, his property. We will take over everything. Now that, if we have to identify perhaps the most difficult part of this whole incident, is David's reaction. Now, certainly, it doesn't seem likely that, you know, they were so starving that, you know, they're going to drop dead. First of all, they're going to drop dead unless they have bread. It's unlikely they're going to have the energy to wage this type of campaign. Presumably, if Nabal doesn't give them what they need, they can go somewhere else and get it. Particularly since David does not offer to pay for anything. David is asking it for free. You know, so I mean, granted, as a matter of charity, we could call Nabal uncharitable. We can call him ungrateful. You know, you can describe his behavior as not, you know, menschlich behavior, so to speak. But it certainly does not warrant. It certainly does not. That's right. It's under people. That's right. That's right. I mean, there's no offer for payment here. And whatever it is, it's reaction. I'm going to kill you all. Seems to be very, very improper. Now, frankly, there's not really a tremendous explanation here. I mean, basically, the halachic categorization of this is that since David, on some level, already has disobeyed the monarch's instructions, constitutes an act of treason in and of itself. It's called Moreid B'Malchut, and Moreid B'Malchut halacha does permit execution. The end of this execution is not a proportional response to what's being done here. I mean, if the king orders you, give me some fruit, and you say no, okay, technically you're an Arabian Malchut. Normal beings say, oh, the king doesn't seem that would be justified. There was a statement that he had no respect for David. He called David an Evangelist. And he does this as a long term. A lot of people like that around. They're not a Malchut later. Even seems like the reaction is very, very strange and really out of shape.
Obviously not
like
that. It's a lucky uncle.
He is being threatened. He is a person that is not very. He has reason not to be secure in the affections that people profess towards him. It's kind of, you know, you got to be tough in this world. But basically, the story, as you know, is that Abigail got wind of what David is trying to do. She goes out, she takes a large number of different foods of different types, fruits and raisins and all sorts of things like that. And she basically tells David that if you want to be king and God should give you the kingship, you should not start your monarchy by an act of cruelty and destruction. This would be a michshol. This would be a stumbling block for you. And David is very grateful. David basically is very grateful. This actually fits into the role of an ideal spouse, that she dissuaded David from engaging in a violence. I think it's fairly clear that David's own reaction indicates that he knows that this was an overreaction, that this would not have been a moral attack. And he is grateful that she dissuaded him from engaging in it. In fact, it's very interesting. I read one of the great rabbis of Prague over the past 300 years was Rav Yecheskel Landau, who's called the Nodab Yehuda. This is the name of his book. One of the great, great rabbis of Prague. And he writes, we have many, many svarim from him, and we also have drashot that he made, and even eulogies.
Landau?
So, Landau, Rav Yecheskel Landau. And he writes, we actually have the record of the eulogy he gave for his wife at her funeral. He wrote it and he printed it. So one of the things he writes there is interesting. He says, many rabbis, come home angry at congregants and everything else, and their wives just confirm them and say, yeah, be angry. You're right. Says, my wife always tried to bring me to see the good in them and to try to be peaceful. And he said that was a very, very rare quality in rabbinic families. So here you have the point that Abigail, indeed, of course she's not his wife yet, she's still married to Nabal, but Abigail indeed dissuaded David from engaging in this violence. And then of course, as when she gets back to Nabal didn't even know what was threatening him, and he was drunk for a while. He was celebrating the sheep shearing, which, by the way, in ancient times, probably even in modern times, was a time of great revelry and drunkenness. When he finally gets sober and he hears what almost happens, so we seem to have a description of a stroke. It's not really clear. It says he became like a dead stone, and essentially he died a short while afterwards, and David married Abigail. So Abigail is, let's get to a second, Abigail is wife number two.
Abigail.
And indeed he married another woman we're not told that much about, Ahinoam. And we're not really told that much about her. So at this point David has two resident wives, Abigail and Ahinoam, and one non-resident wife, which is Michal, who is still living with Palti ben Laish.
When did it become known at this point that David was going to be king? I thought it was still a secret.
Well, it is spreading. Obviously, the as his little group of people grows, 400 to 600, it seems to remain at 600 till Saul's death, the word is spreading that David is king. I mean, Yonatan himself may have indicated that. So there is a growing sense. Now, it's not going to be universal, because we're going to see, even after Saul's death, we're going to see in the book of 2 Shmuel, there is going to be civil war between Shaul's surviving son, who was not Yonatan. Yonatan dies. Yonatan actually would never have made that civil war. Ish-Bosheth is a surviving son. It's the first 2 years, depending on how you learn it. And of course, there are recurring rebellions even after. I'm sorry, did you want to?
Yeah, Nabal, I mean, he wasn't a really great guy here, but maybe he had heard rumor of what Saul did to the prophet.
Yeah.
So when David's asking him for food,
well, that's
he's not such a great guy in the first place, but he's heard what happened, so maybe he doesn't want to.
Well, that's a very good analogy. Listen, in other words, we see from before it's pretty dangerous to give food to David.
And David's right. With his 400 men, and he's saying, "Look, the first time I asked my but I got all these people here behind me, and you know I can take what I want."
Right. The third wife is Michal. In other words, you're suggesting that, are you suggesting that this was just a threat, David was not going to carry out this threat?
Maybe he was, but it was like, this time I'm asking, but you think that I can take what I want.
In other words, don't be dissuaded because of Shaul, because I can do worse.
Isn't it according to law forbidden to take a wife back the second time?
Well, I'll address that. Is
there anything in Chazal that's critical of Abigail that she doesn't tell Nahum until he's cold sober about David's coming? She knows that he's going to react and he's going to have a stroke.
I'm not sure.
In the sources that say that she may have been wicked in doing so.
In other words, is there a suggestion that she was hoping to precipitate his death and thereby marry David? That's an interesting possibility. I have not seen that because there's no reason to automatically assume that she would know that this would cause him to react that way. In other words, we don't have the medical records in front of us, so it's hard to know. But again, it's intriguing. Did she intend to precipitate that type of reaction?
There's nothing in the sources that indicate this.
Well, there's one source that says the following. There's actually one source that says that when the way she stopped David was not only by offering him food, but by making herself sexually available as well. Now, they did not have, they were not together at that point, but she kind of dressed enticingly and the like. So there is that aspect of it. But the precipitating of the death, I'm not aware of. But again, in these matters, you can always speculate as to what was going on. Now the issue of Palti ben... I'm sorry.
Yeah, Nabal Ben, when they came to speak to Abigail, they actually were praising the 400 men.
Because
they've been protecting us, we didn't lose any sheep.
They did acknowledge that the 400 people had protected them, yes.
Maybe for that they...
That's okay, I'm not questioning that perhaps they deserve to be given food.
Right.
I'm just questioning how David says, well, if you don't give me food, I'm going to murder you.
Right.
That seems to be a little excessive. I'm not questioning, but again, think about this, though. It is true that if 400 people showed up, actually it's 600 people, right? Because 400 people are asking. If 600 people showed up at your front door and said, you know, give us something to eat, you know, even if you give them just a bagel each, right? But 600 bagels, quite a lot. You know, so it's a lot to supply, you know.
Say nothing
of
a lot.
Yeah. It is an implied threat just by their being there. How really could he have said no?
Well, and he did.
Yeah.
So Neville's a tough cookie, right? Neville says, and he even says no in a very sarcastic, insulting way. That's right. So in those days, people just were tougher, right? They didn't bend.
How many wives did David have?
I have it written down. David's total, and I'll get to that, is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The book of Shmuel records that he had 6 wives. According to Halacha, he would be allowed to have up to 18 wives, but as far as we know, he had 6 wives. Because Hashem tells him, you can have Kohena v'Kohena. Wives, no more than 18. Okay, so that's not allowed.
The name
Nabal,
is that, are we supposed to assume that really was a given name or is it a symbolic name?
Well, it's hard to know. It's hard to know. It seems to be his given name. Now, why his parents called him Nabal, they may have meant something else. But clearly, the pasuk itself says that the fact that Min HaShemayim, this was his name, was indicative of his character. But you are correct. Sometimes names are not really a person's given name anyway. They're just what they're known as. Maybe he was known as Neville.
Maybe they pronounced him as
Nobel. Maybe Nobel, yeah. That's right. That's right. Neville, right. Right, whatever it might be. Okay, but this is the story of them. Now, chapter 26, once again, this is the second near miss. Now, people mix up the story because people often think this is the story of Shaul sleeping. And again, just people make a common misconception that they say the cutting of the garment was while Shaul was sleeping. That's not true. The cutting of the garment is when Shaul was relieving himself in the cave. This is a different story where Shaul was sleeping, surrounded by his men. David comes down with one of his assistants, Avishai. I'll mention something about him in a moment. And they take from Shaul his water jug and, of course, his ever-present spear. David then stands on the mountain. He wakes them up and says, behold, I have your spear and your water jug. And the same type of thing happens once again, that Shaul is already pursuing David. So the last time didn't make such a big difference. And once again, Shaul is filled with love. By the way, I want to go backwards a little bit on that concept of cutting off the garments. So the first time David cut off the garment, the second time he took the water jug and the spear, you know, at the beginning of the book of Kings, which is the end of David's life when he's 70 years old, it said that he was covered with garments and he could not get warm. He was shivering.
Yeah.
So there's a rabbinic tradition that Rashi brings, right, that he who treats clothing disrespectfully will at the end of their lives not get warmth from their clothing. David treated garments, now it doesn't even say it was the king's garment, he treated the garments disrespectfully by mutilating them. So therefore the garments themselves did not give him warmth. So if your kids throw their clothes around, you can teach them, you got to treat your clothing with respect or the clothing will not help you. You see a very interesting thing. If you extrapolate to this, what this really says is that the concept of gratitude, we have to be grateful, applies even to inanimate objects. That the concept that I have to be grateful to the chair that seats me, to the clothes, that's what gratitude is. And when you treat even things disrespectfully, that shows a lack of hakarat hatov for that which benefits you. You see a similar idea at the Shabbat meal, that we cover up the chalot, right? We cover up the bread before kiddush. And the reason for that is, there are a few reasons. is that we don't want to humiliate the bread. Why don't you want to humiliate the bread? Because normally you begin a meal with bread, hamotzi. But Friday night and Shabbat day, you begin the meal with wine. The bread is going to be ashamed because it's relegated to second place. So we cover up the bread so the bread is not there. Actually, some people don't even bring the bread to the table until after Kiddush. So the bread does not experience the sense of being passed over. Now, obviously, we don't mean this in a literal way, probably. We don't mean the bread feels embarrassed. But these are gestures in which we show appreciation and hakarat hatov to that which gives us so much. And of course, it teaches sensitivity. That's why there's a famous story that the Chafetz Chaim was once at somebody's house. And when they came home after shul Friday night, the chalot were not covered. So the man started yelling at his wife, "Why aren't you covering the chalos? What's going on?" And Chafetz Chaim stopped. Get the reason. The man gave the reason. Because we don't want to embarrass the bread. So he said, so it's so laudable that you're so concerned about the bread that you don't mind embarrassing another human being. Meaning, the point is of all of this, these are rituals which are designed to enhance our sensitivity to not embarrassing. If a person is so concerned about covering up the bread that they're willing to humiliate another human being, they obviously have not absorbed the very lesson of the ritual. Which, by the way, is an important aspect of Jewish education, and that is often, and I say this, you know, even in the most orthodox, and maybe precisely in the most orthodox, it's a serious problem, where there is such a concentration, and, you know, and rightly so in many ways, on the details of a halachic observance, but without necessarily emphasizing the imperative of extrapolating the moral lesson of that ritual. So one could spend an hour talking about how do you have to cover up the challah without necessarily developing this lesson in human sensitivity. But anyway, it is important. That's the idea of the cutting off the garment is very very simple, very significant. Kol hamavazeh et habegadim, one who treats clothing with disrespect will not benefit from that clothing.
Kol hamavazeh
et habegadim, sofo eino nehaneh mehem. In the end, he will not get benefits from those, because not only from those, but from any begadim. Because
there is in Talmud.
This is in the Talmud, yeah.
That is all true, and it's, you know, what you just said about teaching and with the connected mitzvah, which I had learned earlier too. But, you know, you don't let your children throw clothes on the floor or just disregard them.
That's
because
correct.
They are earned. But if God forbid there was a fire, you would need, let's say, your clothes to save the door and leave the smoke out.
Sure.
But wait a minute.
Yeah.
David saved his life by taking this garment. There was no other proof to show that he had been so close to killing him. So
well,
wasn't it a close disregard?
Well, you say saved his life. What exactly did David get out of this? Shaul's continuing?
He got peace. Certainly, where he had recognition.
Maybe for a day. I'm not sure. I mean, basically, that happens. But you know, Shaul is already. I mean, basically. You're assuming.
I'm saying he did. Because he had disregard for the.
No, but it depends how you understand the story. In other words, the question would become the following. Remember, David is hiding in the back of the cave.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Shaul is not aware of David's presence.
Right.
Now, if David would have done nothing, and Shaul would have relieved himself and left the cave, are you saying that David then would have been hunted down? You know,
for a while again.
He
would have come out of the cave if Shaul thought he was in that area.
So David would have stayed in the cave till Shaul left. But I understand what you're saying. But you're arguing that you're arguing that maybe the narrative is telling me that if it wouldn't have been for this event. David Shaul would have continued to pursue him that very day and perhaps would have found him. There might be other ways. You know, maybe he could have taken the whole garment, which really would have put Shaul in trouble.
The fear.
Yeah.
We don't know what David's motivation was. It could just have been to embarrass him. You know, he didn't control what Saul controlled.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
By taking his coat.
Okay, we don't know. But you're suggesting the idea that this was pikuach nefesh. This was similar to using clothes to stop a fire or something. Yes. a good point. That's right. That's right. That's right. Sha'ul grabs Shmuel's garment and rips it. Yeah, I believe there's a midrash that even connects it to that. That since Sha'ul rips Shmuel's garment, Sha'ul gets his garment ripped. But since David ripped Shmuel's garment, so David in effect doesn't benefit from his garment. This is what Hillel said. It's, in Pirkei Avot it says that Hillel once saw a skull, a human skull, floating on the river. And he said the following: because you drowned somebody, that's why you're drowned. And the one that drowned you is going to get drowned too.
Isn't there a distinction? One is an accident, like spoil, there.
Yeah. Well, it is true. It is true. And Sha'ul did not. Sha'ul grabbed hold of the garments. It happened to tear. Yeah, it is certainly a thing. But there are still parallels in terms of what happened.
But why didn't David really kill him?
The word by what is the actual verb that is used? Let's see, because it depends on the verb. Maybe you could tell them that this was in Perek Chaf Dalet. Let's see. Korsi, I was koveit, I cut. Let's see. Vayishasa, no, in seconds. Karat et akonat. Yeah, I'm not sure if the word indicates an even cut or a cut, or not on the scene. I'm not sure anything. To be koveit, it's a little unusual. It does not use the verb for tear, which is korea, which uses the word for cut. Now maybe cut implies even on the sema, but I'm not sure exactly. Koret is different than korea. Okay, but be it as it may, this is the second encounter, and this is the last encounter that David has with Sha'ul. Now chapter 27 is written here. Chapter 27 almost seems to be a non sequitur, because chapter 26 ends with Sha'ul professing love and affection and concern. Chapter 27, David says, I can't do this anymore. He's going to get me one of these days. I got to go into Philistine territory. Meaning to say, the transition is so opposite of what the end of the parak says, that what the author is conveying is, David is sick of this cat and mouse business. He's sick of, one day he loves me, the next day he's going to kill me. I'd rather be with somebody who is a known enemy, so I could prepare myself in a constant relation, than to have this, one day I'm your friend and one day I want to kill you. And therefore, David, for the second time, makes his way into Philistine territory. But this is very different than the first time. Remember, in the first time, he went there anonymously as a fugitive, and he presumably did not want to make his presence known. And when he was apprehended by the Philistines, that was the famous scene where he behaved as if he was crazy. And Achish basically said, I have enough crazy people, I don't need another Meshuggah here. And he sends him back. This time is very different. First of all, it's not so easy for David to hide himself, because he's entering Philistine territory with 600 people. And it's less believable. You know, you can't have 600 people behaving crazy. It would be like letting an insane asylum loose. So what David does is, David basically says to the king of the Philistines, whose name is Achish, listen, I am being pursued by the Israelite king. He is my enemy. He wants to destroy me. I offer my services to you, basically as a group of mercenaries.
That's terrible.
Well, David actually communicates that he is going over to the other side. Not only that, but he even asks for a town. He says, listen, I need a base. You don't want me to use up the municipal service of Gath, is one of the major Philistine cities. So, the king of the Philistines actually assigns to its group a town in Philistine territory that is called Siklag. And there's a little historical note that the author of the book tells us that to this very day, we don't know what this very day is because the book of Shmuel was written after the death of everybody, Siklag belonged to kings of Judah. meaning from that day forward, it became a private, a Camp David or whatever. We don't know how far it was from Jerusalem exactly, but it was like Camp David. It was like a private royal town, and this was actually given through a grant from the Philistine king, Achish, the king of Gat. David remains there for only 4 months, but that's very significant because during these four months.
A year and 4 months.
Huh?
It says a year and 4 months.
I'm sorry, what passage is that?
Seven.
Some days.
Yeah, 1 second. Let me just find the passage.
I'm reading the wrong one. Where are we
it
up?
It says it on this tip.
No, we're on
a
Perek Chaf Zion.
Right, seven.
Right. 1 second. Perek Chaf Zion. Mispar Yomim Sheyeshav David B'Stei Pelishtim Yamim Ba'Arba'a Chodesh. Yeah, the question is, what is Yamim? Yes, that's right. There are different interpretations. Literally, it means some days and 4 months. If you read this according to one pshat, it was 4 months with a few days. According to other explanations, the word Yamim is as if it refers to a year.
With Rivka.
That's right, that's right. So it's either a year and 4 months or 4 months. But it throws off the 2 year reign of Shaul. That's right, that's right, that's right. This is the book that these are the months that Shaul and Yonatan actually die, meaning to say, David remains essentially with the Philistines until the death of Shaul. We will see that. That is, he's out of commission. Now, David engages in a deception that seems to be fairly transparent, but he gets away with it, at least for a short period of time. He goes around plundering with his gang various, not Philistine enclaves, but enclaves of different nations like Amalek. Remember, Amalek is apparently still around. So that's why it's very difficult to imagine. If you read the narrative in chapter 15, it appears to be the case that Saul killed all of the Amalekim except for one person who's the king, and Shmuel then finished off that person. Now, granted, we say Haman could descend from them because the king got somebody pregnant, so there was one baby left over, so to speak. But still, you're not going to have hordes of Amalekim around shortly afterwards. And yet, we read consistently in the book of Shmuel that there were groups, there were enclaves of Amalekim that were still around. So apparently it's very, very clear that Shaul did not finish off. In other words, there was more than just Agag, that there were enclaves that he wasn't able to get power over. And what David does is, David plunders these various enclaves. He then destroys them. He reports by the Philistine king that these are the spoils of Jewish settlements. So you see what David is trying to do. David is trying to prove his loyalty to the Philistine cause by showing that he's willing to attack and even kill fellow Jews, although he was not doing that. Now, why does he have to prove his loyalty in such a way? There are two reasons. One is, that is the only way he can get physical security for himself, because if he's suspected of being disloyal to the Philistines, they'll kill him or imprison him. And number two, it appears similar to Shimshon. If you remember, Shimshon was engaged in similar types of things, and the concept was he wanted the Philistines to think of him as an ally, so that somehow as a fifth column he would be able to diffuse some of their activities against the Jewish people. So he fools, and actually says he gets away with this. And finally, the king is very, very convinced of his loyalty. And in the campaign against the Jews, Achish actually wants David and his soldiers to join the Philistine army and fight against the Jews. David apparently wanted this to happen because David could then undermine the Philistines from within. But what's interesting is that the Philistine counselors are very much against it. They raise the accusation. Once again, they bring up to Achish the old song, the old ditty, Hika Shaul B'Alafar. He says, Achish, are you crazy? You want this man to fight in your army of whom the women always sang? Shaul has killed the thousands, and David has smote the 10,000s, and we're the thousands and the 10,000s that they're talking about? So Achish is very apologetic. Achish actually tells David, you know, I trust you, I'd love to have you in the army, but what can I do? My generals are all against it. And very reluctantly, he sends David and his men back to Siklag. So in this Siklag, that was the royal city that was given to David. So what you have here is, this is very important, because what it means is, this last campaign where Shaul and Yonatan get killed, David and his men were sitting it out. They were not there at all. They were excused from the army. Could there have been a different outcome to this battle had David been on the Philistine side? Perhaps there could have been. Obviously, it was in the divine plan of things that the Jewish people would suffer a grievous defeat, and in a sense, therefore, David was sent away. Here, for a third time, there is a mention of Shmuel's death for no apparent reason, other than it once again sets the scene of why Shaul needs to bring him up from the dead, because Shmuel is not there. And in chapter 28, this brings us to the very, very famous scene of what is called the Baalat Ov. Baalat Ov is the sorceress or the witch, but specifically, it's a specific type of sorcery, the ability to communicate with the dead. We believe that there is such a power that exists. The Torah prohibits using it. The Torah prohibits the use of this type of magic and sorcery to communicate from the dead. And we are told that Shmuel, one of the things that Shmuel did was, Shmuel eliminated from the land that type of prohibited sorcery or magic. Now, this gets into a whole big discussion. Is there such a thing as magic? Now, Maimonides writes, Maimonides, who generally had a very rationalistic bent, is that there is no such thing as this type of magic. All of this is just an illusion. In other words, it's fake. Of course, the question becomes, so if there's no such thing, what is the Torah prohibiting when it prohibits it? So is the Torah prohibiting the illusion of doing something? Well, that's a very strict position. If the Torah prohibits the illusion of doing something, how can I hire a magician for my son's birthday party? You can say, well, that's not real magic. But so what? There's no such thing as real magic. So the Torah must be addressing fake magic, right? So the simple meaning is very, very different. The simple meaning is that on levels that we don't fully understand, there are dark forces of impurity. They involve demons. They may involve other types of things that we don't perceive rationally. And a person could tap into those dark forces, and the Torah prohibits utilization of those forces on a supernatural level. So consequently, fake magic is perfectly okay. You can do card tricks and everything else because that's not magic. But real magic would be forbidden. You know, and I'm sure all of you know the Harry Potter books about, you know, so there is actually, I mean, I have no problem with them, but there is actually among some fundamentalist Christians in particular the concept that because these books glorify sorcery and witchcraft and these various powers, they are considered pagan and idolatrous and should not be read. But indeed it is true that a lot of what Harry Potter does in Hogwarts or whatever the name of the school is would be a violation of the laws of the Torah prohibiting that type of witchcraft and sorcery. Now in chapter 28 you get a very almost emotionally painful description of what Shaul feels at this moment of his greatest challenge. The Philistines have a huge campaign. David was sent back, so David is not involved in this. And Shaul, well, let me just read you the words here. Look at chapter 28. Chapter 28, verse 5. And this is the biggest Philistine army that has ever assembled against the Jews. Vayar Shaul ki es machaneh plishtim. Shaul sees the camp of the Philistines. Vayira, and he is fearful. Vayacharad libo mod, and his heart trembles. Vayishal Shaul b'Hashem, and he asks God for guidance through the Urim b'Tumim. Vayro ano Hashem. God gives him no answer. Nothing. Gam b'chalamot, there is no vision or dream that comes to him. Gam b'urim v'gam b'nevi'im. The Urim v'Tumim, right? What are his three avenues? A dream may come to him. the Urim V'Tumim, or a prophet. Nothing. The nothingness of being totally abandoned. And Shaul panics. He doesn't know what to do. And finally, look at this, in the last act of desperation, he says, the only one who could help me is not here anymore. The only one that can help me is Shmuel. I gotta see Shmuel. But Shmuel is dead. I'll bring him up from the dead. But the Torah says you're not allowed to do that. Not only that, but the very person you want to bring up had eradicated the sorcerers and the magicians and the witches. And Shaul gives this order out of desperation. Find me a witch. Find me a sorceress. Find somebody in this country that still does this stuff. And indeed, a woman is identified in a city, Ein Dor. Shaul disguises himself as if he's a commoner, because the problem would be she would feel it's entrapment. If Shaul HaMelech comes in looking for a sorceress, knowing that Shaul's policy was against this, she feels she'd be putting her life in danger. So he dresses up as somebody else, and he basically says, bring me up the person that I want. He doesn't say who it is at first. And the woman gives a whole speech. Well, you know, Shaul says this is illegal, and of course we don't break the law. Why do you want me to break the law? And Shaul swears, I will spare your life. And then the woman asks, who do you want me to bring up? And he finally says, Shmuel. Now apparently, if you read the narrative, apparently, I'm not familiar with this intimately, but apparently, assuming that this works, the only one that sees the dead person is the Balat Ov herself, because Shaul did not see the Balat Ov. This is the sorceress. Because Shaul cannot describe what she has to describe to him, what she sees.
But they talk.
And they talk. They
no,
talk.
Shaul does.
Yes, Shaul does talk. It doesn't indicate that there's an intermediary in the speech. So Shaul can hear the voice, but only she can see. And here, she describes. She actually says, Shaul asks, "What do you see?" And she says, "I see God coming from the earth, Elohim." But this is interpreted as a godly man or a godlike person. It doesn't refer to God himself. And how do you describe him? So she says, Ish Zakein Oleh, an old man, and he's wearing a me'il. Now there's a beautiful midrash that says the me'il is he's wearing a coat. If you remember at the very beginning of the book of Shmuel, it says when Chana brought Shmuel to the Beit to the Mishkan at the age of two, she made him a little me'il. And there's a beautiful midrashic tradition that this me'il grew with him. And it stayed with him all of his life. And even when he comes back from the dead, the me'il that he has is the me'il that his mother made for him when he was 2 years old. It stayed with him on some level. And when he hears that Shmuel, of course she shrieks, and she then says, why didn't you tell me you're Shaul? Now, of course, how does she know he's Shaul? He still didn't tell her he's Shaul. But the answer would be, she figures, Shmuel would not come back unless there was a royal request. Shmuel doesn't come back because somebody wants to talk to Shmuel.
Right.
So now she shrieks, and now she's scared for her life. And now Shmuel says to Shaul directly, why have you disturbed my rest? Why have you taken me from the dead? And Shaul just says, I am in such great distress. The Philistines are fighting against me. God has turned away from me. Well, you can imagine what this conversation is like. And God has not answered me through his prophets, through his dreams. And I've called you just to tell me, what do I do? All I want is a little help here. And Shmuel is very cold. Shmuel says, what are you asking me questions? If God hasn't answered you, it's because God has turned away from you. God has rejected you. God has torn away the malchut from you just as he told you ahead of time. So what's the problem? You have all the answers to your question. As you have not listened to Hashem, Hashem has not listened to you. And then he says...
When didn't he listen to Hashem?
Well, Amalek. This is not story.
Well,
Amalek. We went through this. Now, look at verse 19. Vayitein Hashem. So now this is the actual bad news. God will deliver the Israelites together with you in the hands of the Plishtim. Umachar. And tomorrow. Ata uvanecha imi. You and your children, who will be fighting with you, including Yonatan, will be with me. In other words, they'll be in the other world. Gam machane Yisrael, and the camp of the Jews, Yitain Hashem biyad Pelishtim. Now, there is a beautiful midrash, though, that says the following. In Shmuel's very harsh words, and in this frightening prediction of what will happen, and of course all of this did happen, there are words of comfort. Because Shmuel is telling him, tomorrow you will be with me. You will be where I am in Olam Haba. That God, on this level, has ultimately forgiven you. God understands that you've broken down or whatever psychological process. And you need to be taken from this world because you can't be king anymore. And David has to rule. But in the spiritual ultimate sense, you will be forgiven. And you will be with me. So the imi is actually understood, imi b'mechitzati, with me in my mechitza, my compartment in Olam Haba. It's interesting that a similar promise was made, the Midrash says, to Yeravam ben Nevat. This is much later. Yeravam ben Nevat was the first king of the northern 10 tribes. And the Midrash recounts that God once came to Yeravam ben Nevat and said, Yeravam, do tshuva, and if you do tshuva, I, David, and you will walk together in Olam Haba. So it says we'll be together in the world to come. So Yeravam ben Nevat asked, who's going to be first? And when God answered, David will be ahead of you, he says, no, I don't want the deal. But some of the commentaries say the following, that when he was asking who was going to be first, he wasn't only complaining about David being first. He wasn't going to be God, are you going to be ahead? You know, that's how much the arrogance went. But again, you know, this is really a very, very gripping. I know there's a famous, was it Gustav Dore, the very famous biblical illustrator of the 19th century, has very striking black and white drawings. So he has a famous painting of the Witch of Endor, the darkness, the shadows, the fear, the trepidation, the desperation, and the remnants of goodness within Shaul that Shmuel is willing to acknowledge even in this scenario with the Imi, right? The tortured nature. We always talk about David as being tortured. And to Tehillim, David expresses his emotions, but the truth of the matter is, David was a relatively straightforward personality. David was impulsive, David was strong, David could be vindictive, etc. But the total contradictions are much more pronounced in Shaul. And in this sense, we are told that Shaul bowed to the ground. Of course, let me point out that in spite of the prediction that he would die in the battle of the Philistines, he went to battle. He went knowing and believing, because he believed in what Shmuel told him, knowing that he would die. And that itself was considered to be a great heroism. He was not going to abandon his troops. And of course, the one thing we can say about Shaul that always emerges positive is that he was a very courageous warrior. We see that from the very beginning, that he was willing to risk his life in the heat of battle. And he did that as well here. He went out to battle knowing that he would die. Just to give you another parallel of that, we know that in 1938, 1939, there were a number of very, very great rabbis who happened to be in America on fundraising missions. And they were urged to stay, and they could have stayed. They were offered positions which would allow them to stay. But they basically said that I'm going to go back to my communities and to my students and not to abandon them in the time of need. And I remember just seeing a picture that was very striking of one of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, one of the great rabbis, who was on the ship back to Poland in 1939. And he was gazing, just shows him gazing into the ocean. You get the impression that he knows exactly what he is going into. He was not going to abandon his people at that time.
This chapter is the hardest chapter, and I'm an Orthodox person and religious and believe in Hashem. I cannot believe this happened.
Oh, you don't so believe this happened?
It just, if we believe a sorcerer is not allowed and should be put to death.
That's correct.
Where does the sorcerer bring up Shmuel?
Well, are you asking, are you saying that it didn't happen, or you're asking how could she be allowed to? Well, the truth
is, in other words,
yeah.
Hashem tells you no, and now Hashem permits it.
Who said Hashem permitted it?
How do you bring up the dead if Hashem doesn't?
Well, it's like every sin. I mean, if I kill somebody, it happened. It happened. It doesn't mean it was allowed to happen.
But this is not something.
No, but apparently the understanding is this is the thing that we don't understand. Apparently the concept is if you know how to bring up the dead, you can bring up the dead. Just like you know how to drive a car, right? This is a skill.
You believe the dead can be.
Well, I have not experienced this, but I believe that it must be possible. Now, of course, they
by a sorcerer, and not through.
That well, again, as I say,
Hashem did it with Eliyahu.
No. One thing. I think you're confusing two things. This was not a revival of the dead.
No, not a revival.
We're not talking. This is the soul. The soul, which is exists, come back and reveal itself in earth. This is not a physical resurrection.
No, this is possible to be.
Apparently, it is. That's what a Baal Ov, a man is called, a Baal Ov. A master of Ov, of bringing up the dead.
Ot?
Ov. Aleph, Vav, Bet. Ov.
Is it sinful not to believe this could have happened?
Well, I never heard of
Ov. Yeah, Ov, it's in the Torah. Well, the alternative is what? Sheol had a dream. Sheol was in hypnotic trance. Those things are possible. In a sense, even that dream would be a vision from God in some way. That maybe Sheol had a vision of her bringing up Shmuel. That might be a possibility.
It
doesn't say it's a vision, so it seems to be that it happens.
There's an implicit message.
Yeah.
But this will never help you.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. That Sheol violated the Torah to get help, and it didn't help him. That's right. So, but again, all I want to say is the fact that something was allowed to happen is not the same thing as saying something is allowed. In other words, we're not saying you're allowed to do it. Like, you're not allowed to do this. But in fact, it happens because, just like many things happen that are improper, but they happen.
What I find amazing in the, I guess in the entire things that, this example which is forbidden, and yet it is decided to keep it, to keep the story. I mean, you would think that somewhere along the line there would be an editor that say, hey, we really can't.
Well, one might say, though, that this is part of the general, whatever Sheol does something wrong, there was no attempt to cover it up. I mean, this is part of the pattern of, this is something else he did wrong, But you see the tragedy of it, because once again, this is the tragedy of trying to get it right, but doing it wrong. I mean, what is he trying to do? He's trying to contact the Navi. He's trying to connect to Hashem. He's trying to get spiritual guidance.
So why did he have no answer? The way he had no answer with the Urim and the other dream.
He had no answer because that was the answer. The answer is God has left you. That is your answer.
I understand.
So all he gets from this message is, well, I'm telling you, God has left you. The answer he gets is no different than the answer he already got.
We don't believe in sorcerers, and yet this is a faith in sorcerer. This sorcerer could have brought up Shmuel.
No. We don't believe. We believe that there are sorcerers. We believe in sorcery, but we believe you're not allowed to invoke it.
Right.
That doesn't mean we don't believe there's such a thing. Two different things. What you're not allowed to do isn't the same as a denial that there's such a possible reality that exists in the world. Now, they do say, Maimonides does write that all of these things don't exist, although I don't know exactly how he interprets this. So somebody once said, the Vilna Gaon has a comment, that Maimonides was led astray by his over-rationalistic faith in Greek philosophy. And somebody asked the Kutzker Rebbe, famous Hasidic Rebbe, gee, if Maimonides is wrong, If there are such things, why don't we ever see them? So the Kutzker Rebbe answered, well, there certainly are such things, but if Maimonides says there are no such things, even the demons have to listen to him. So they disappeared. Yeah.
Isn't it known that some powers don't exist anymore? In the power of time, there were magicians who really did magic, which can't be done anymore. I think I read somewhere that this kind of sorcery was at one at one time possible but doesn't exist anymore.
Okay, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if the idea was the possibilities don't exist or the practitioners don't exist. It could very well be. It's
the
a loss. I'm not sure about that. I think it's fairly clear we don't have practitioners of this, although people have Ouija boards and things like that, which might be somewhat.
But
connected.
The Rambam feels maybe that cannot be done now.
The Rambam feels it could not be done. Yeah.
They're reading your palm, isn't the same thing?
Yes, it is. Yeah, these are similar types
of
things.
You're not supposed to.
That's correct. That's right. Yeah.
Never be.
What that's actually right. bothers me that Shaul is actually taking care of those killers. But what happens to the host of Israel? The whole host of Israel is destroyed here.
Well, but I've described they're defeated.
They're
separate.
And killed.
That's a separate thing. That's not saying it's because of Shaul. They're just saying that this is a war in which there's going
to
be defeat for whatever.
Nothing to do with Shaul.
Not directly. Now, there's one just... I'm sorry, Jim.
What's upsetting me is we said there were only three options for Shaul.
Yeah, Chalomot, Navi, and Orin Tzumim, right?
But wasn't Tefillah?
Sure. But the idea is that... to get any of those three options, tefillah unlocks all three, or any of the three. In other words, he prays to God to get guidance, but then how does he get his guidance? He's get his guidance by chalamot, nevi'im, or urim v'tumim.
Whoa.
Those were not to the exclusion of tefillah, but tefillah would be the key to get either
prayer
of those three.
Prayer isn't direct?
In other words, if he prays to God, God would talk to him directly? Well, yes, but God would talk to him directly only through a dream, meaning to say that Shaul was not a Navi in the sense of direct communication. Even when Shaul had his experiences, and Hagam Shaul Ba-Navi'im, he was always in a trance-like state. Chalamot doesn't have to refer to a night dream. Chalamot refers to the meditative trance which Shaul occasionally experienced prophetic inspiration. So Tefillah, I assume, would be the precursor to any of those three ways. And therefore God was not answering his tefillot. Now, one other thing. There are two final events here, and that is, there is a long digression. Remember, David, while all this is happening, David and his 600 people are in Ziklag. Now, it is said that when he was sent back from the Philistine army and he goes to Ziklag, the city of Ziklag had been plundered, not by Philistines, but had been plundered by Amalekim and the like, and David's wives were kidnapped, and a lot of people were taken captive. And it is said that David's own men wanted to mutiny against him because his negligence in leaving the women and the children in Ziklag had made them vulnerable to those types of attacks. So we are given a little story of how David avenged that plunder. David successfully reclaimed the captives and the property and took a lot of spoils from the Amalekim and the like. And we are given an act of charity here because only 400 men went on this little expedition, 200 stayed with the possessions, and the question is, should the spoils be divided only among the 400, or even the 200? And David enacted, right? David made a military rule that applied in his reign, that spoils shall be divided equally among the fighters and among the backline troops, and this became a chok ad hayom hazeh, that if you, whether you were behind the lines or in the front lines, you would share equally in the spoils. Again, it sounds a little funny to me because this is portrayed as, generous, benevolent, compassionate, when it does involve, you know, plundering, taking... We're very generous because when we plunder from the enemy, we divide it equally among everybody. But on the other hand, remember, too, that a lot of the plunder was actually plunder that had been taken from them. On the other hand, I don't think that was divided equally, because I assume what was taken from you would be given back to the proper owners. This must refer to the extra stuff that was taken. So that's kind of a little surgical action while all of this major Philistine stuff is happening. And the final battle is in Mount Gilboa. Again, we know where the site is. It's kind of in the middle of Eretz Israel.
I'm confused about the fact that David Abiatar, they seem to have the
yes.
And at the same time, Shaul is also inquiring.
Yeah, this is a very, very interesting problem. Clearly, the implication of these verses are that there's more than one Urim V'Tumim. Yeah. one more than one breastplate, etc. Now that's a problem because there's only one Kohen Gadol. And the Urim V'Tumim seems to be part of the Begadim of the Kohen Gadol. How could there be more than one? The assumption indeed seems to be, although this was not borne out in later rabbinic literature, that at least in ancient times, the Urim V'Tumim was not limited to a Kohen Gadol, but any Kohen could function as somewhat of an oracle to be able to give us a form of divine response similar to prophecy. But that is a good point. That bothered me as well. I had not seen an explanation about the possibility of more than one Kohen having an Urim V'Tumim. Remember, just for as a matter of definition, Urim V'Tumim is not the name of the breastplate with the jewels. The name of the breastplate with the jewels is called Choshen, the breastplate. Urim V'Tumim was a scroll of parchment that had various names of God that you would put behind the jewels, and that would somehow give the jewels the ability to communicate prophetically. And the way it worked was that the names of the tribes were engraved on every jewel, and you have all the letters of the alphabet, and as questions were asked, lights, the letters, would light up that would spell the particular word that you needed. That's why you had to be relatively short. Should I go? So came. There'd be a perfect. You couldn't really do long sentences this way. And there was also a problem that, according to many, only the Kohen Gadol saw the lighting. It was, again, similar to the Balat Oath. Only she saw the dead body.
Right.
And the Kohen Gadol would have to decipher it because sometimes the spelling of the word did not correspond to the order.
So what is that fraud?
Huh? The ephod is an apron-like garment that to which the breastplate was attached. In other words, the breastplate was attached to the ephod, which was girded around the Kohen Gadol. Yeah.
There weren't two Urim V'Tumim, because when Shaul killed the city of the Kohanim, only
right.
one son ran away to David, so he had it.
Yes.
It says here in this passage right. that Shaul had no avenue. He had no dream.
Yeah.
He had no prophet.
Okay,
he had no Urim.
Well, okay. So that's the question. Your point is a good point. In other words, your question is when it says God did not answer him through the Urim V'Tumim.
It wasn't available.
Okay, you're correct. One way of understanding it is that it wasn't there at all. Yeah.
Right. Gone.
Yeah, although the implication seems to be, I think the language supports the idea that it was there but didn't answer. But you're correct. Certainly what you're saying is a possibility which would answer your problem of were there two or one. There was one, and that one was with David, and that's why Shaul wasn't answered, because it wasn't there. Yeah, I think that is a possible explanation.
That's
although I think the Lashon implies it was there but not...
That's